Welcome on to a special Friday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. Danny, I think we made the right decision to record tonight, huh?
Yeah, I mean, we got two really fun games for their own reasons, one that was actually good.
I think you might be the only one who considered that that Clippers Houston game to be that good, but with because of your prescient tweet.
Hey, it happens, you know. you get one high point on Twitter, and it happened to come at basically midnight Eastern during a game that was already over.
Oh, come on now! You're over 650 retweets on that already. So because Danny hates to toot his own horn, of course, he predicted that there was a 95% chance that Austin Rivers would at some point do the James Harden stirring the pot celebration, and of course, he did today.
So, and the one thing I'll note is I predicted that 12 days ago. That was before the series was set. Like, I mean, I don't know. Austin Rivers has always been a fascination for me, and it was just one of those things. I mean, I was talking about somebody, and I'm like, yeah, I did have him sixth in that draft class, so it's not like I know everything about Austin Rivers.
Wow, so yeah, I wouldn't have thought anyone would have him higher than the Pelicans did in that class, but apparently someone did, yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe this is him turning the corner. Maybe.
No, it's not.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get to the real good game, which was Chicago-Cleveland. The big takeaway on this one for me is that Tom Thibodeau finally relented. He finally played Nikola Mirotic after a miserable first quarter in which the Bulls were getting killed in transition defense. He put in Mirotic and Joakim Noah. And guess what? Mirotic was plus 19 for the game. Nobody else on either team anywhere close to double digits in plus minus.
Yeah, and you could see it in a lot of different ways. That's part of the reason why his plus minus is kind of better than his personal stats, because him being out there, and we saw a little bit of this with Spencer Hawes in the second game, having a big man who can shoot completely changes the dynamic of the defense, and you saw the lanes for Derrick Rose and Jimmy Butler just open up because they had to respect Nico's jump shot.
Yeah, and he was actually totally fine on defense as well. And then, as it turned out, Gasol ended up leaving the game in the third quarter with a hamstring issue, which he said later had been bothering him since game two, which made sense because he wasn't very good in game two either. And then they went with Taj Gibson at center, and he was also fantastic at center.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways Taj was the underrated star of this game. I thought that his impact was massive, and we might finally get what a lot of people, and you were obviously higher on this than me because you follow this team more closely, but the two best big men for Chicago in this playoffs and through the end of the regular season were the two guys that were the best in this game, and they actually got minutes.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, Gibson has not been that great throughout the year. He's struggled with his own injury issues. But against this Cleveland team that doesn't really have a post threat, he works really well because, and we talked about it in response to that listener question of what the ideal lineup would be. And against this Cleveland team, Taj is great because he can switch out onto guys like LeBron James. He can move his feet well enough against guys like James and Irving, when he's playing the five in the pick and roll, to still stay in front of them and then contest them at the rim. The only thing he's not amazing at is on the defensive boards, but the Bulls were able to avoid getting totally killed on the defensive glass in this game because their perimeter players helped out a lot more. And that's really a very underrated aspect of defensive rebounding. And, you know, you'll remember that's why the Clippers got killed on the defensive glass in that game 7 against the Spurs, is because their smalls can't rebound. And when you have a guy like Thompson, really, the center who's guarding him just has to box him out. And then if you can keep your body on him, then the small guys, even though they're smaller than Thompson, they get a running start. And they can jump over Thompson because he's still engaged with the big. It's when you don't get the help from guys like Rose, who had 7 rebounds, and Butler, who I think was right around that area too. When they don't get the help, that's when Thompson can really start to kill you.
Yeah, and that's, yeah, rebounding is a team effort, and the other guy, you brought him up towards the end of that. I mean, obviously rebounding wasn't his best thing in this game, but Jimmy Butler was fabulous. He was a remarkably good player. The defense he played on LeBron, I thought from start to finish, was really, really good, and LeBron didn't look like himself as a scorer for most of this game, but that's been true for the last couple.
Yeah, it has, and really just from an efficiency standpoint, it's been the case all season. And there are a lot of Miami people, fans, or I'm sure people in the organization as well, who felt like LeBron didn't necessarily give Miami enough credit, that he became so much better of a player when he came there, despite the fact that he had lost athleticism from his Cleveland days, and he was able to shoot this amazing percentages and you know, get up to like 56, 57% from the field, unbelievable percentages for a perimeter player. And that's because of the Miami system. He wasn't shooting at those levels until really they started adopting the kind of space and pace system. And now that he's back in Cleveland, it's all him holding the ball. It's going against a set defense all the time. And his shots are much harder. And he's not as good of a player probably as he was in Miami either. And now he, against a real locked-in playoff defense and a great defender like Butler, he's not able to be an efficient scorer.
And in this game, he wasn't helped by, it looks like Kyrie Irving was off physically. He tweaked his ankle, I think it was his left ankle, early in the game, and Coach David Blatt said after the game that he'd been dealing with a foot issue. I don't know if it looked like they
were separate things. Yeah, since game two of the Celtics series, supposedly.
So, without Kevin Love, it feels like Kyrie's going to have to be that secondary guy that you have to pay attention to. And yeah, J.R. Smith made a series of huge, huge shots in this game, and Shumpert had another good game, and he's dealing with his own groin injury. But they're going to need Kyrie at some point during this playoffs if they want to make a real long run.
How did, finishing up your point with Kyrie, yeah, I mean, he just did not have the explosion at the rim. And granted, it was Gibson contesting him a lot, too. That was really important. I mean, Kyrie, I think, only had two shot attempts, both of which were threes in the first half, as LeBron had like 13 attempts. And then they made a real effort to go to him in the pick and roll, operating at the beginning of the third quarter, and the Bulls were able to successfully contest him at the rim, which they were not able to do, especially in game two. So, and they were able to contest without fouling, which was also key. So that was huge. But my next question for you is, how did Shumpert look to you?
I thought he took a couple of shots that surprised me, you know, doing that. But defensively, when they put him on Rose, I thought he did a reasonably good job. It was, again, shocking, you know, that storyline that you and I have talked about before, that we always thought that the benefit of starting him was that you'd put him on Rose. But from what I recall, early on in the game, they didn't do that, but they did do it more later.
Yeah, they did. I mean, and the reason that the matchups get all messed up for Cleveland is that LeBron is not guarding Butler, or doesn't really want to guard Butler, and maybe that's to keep him fresh. Again, that goes back to the fact that, you know, he has the ball in his hands on every play. He's trying to create on every play instead of kind of letting the game come to him off of ball movement. And so maybe they feel like he can't guard Butler all game, and that messes up the matchups, because then you got to put Shumpert on Butler. Butler can overpower him, and or you got to put JR on Butler, which also doesn't really work. Butler had his way with JR
on the last second to last play too, which was a beautiful play that got lost in the shuffle of Derrick Rose's amazing shot.
Oh, don't worry, we'll get to that. I think that with LeBron not able to guard Butler, that basically ends up forcing Kyrie onto Rose. And whenever that happened, Rose was really, especially in the second half, Rose was able to attack Irving and get to the basket. Irving, never a great defender, especially with his kind of injuries now, has not been anywhere close to passable on the defensive end. Here's a question for you. What is the more significant injury for Cleveland? What is worse for Cleveland? Kyrie looking the way he is, or Pau Gasol being injured for Chicago?
I think it's Pau, because
I do too, and I hate
Pau,
to say that.
Pau opens up the it's not a Pandora's box, but opens up the possibility of a much better Bulls team that is the worst nightmare for Cleveland, because Kyrie's great and he's a huge player, but Mirotić takes so many of Cleveland's strengths away, because you pull a guy out, it really hurts that two big lineup that has been dominating on the offensive glass because it changes where Tristan Thompson is on the floor. And Taj has done a nice job, too. I mean, what's crazy is, I mean, I think we both would feel that, at least broadly, that Noah has been the bigger culprit in their big man problems than Pau Gasol. But it opened it up either way.
Well, Gasol was horrendous in transition defense in that first quarter when the Bulls' half-court defense was fantastic, but they just kept giving up plays. And a lot of that, too, was missing shots at the rim. When you have one of your small guys miss a shot at the rim, then you're really in trouble on transition defense. And then, you know, Gasol got beat in transition by Mozgov a couple of times. You'd imagine he's never that quick normally, but then with the hamstring, I think he just wasn't really able to sprint at all. But really what is, I mean, Gasol can be an effective player. It's just, as we've talked about before, he wasn't being used right. He's being used in the two center lineup. He's wasn't really being used against bench guys where he could actually have an effect posting up because he wasn't really, you know, going against the starters wasn't really good enough posting up and would get tired because he was playing so many minutes. So if he wasn't, although he's definitely not a bad player, when used incorrectly, he was playing ahead of superior players. And we saw that Gibson and Mirotić are just much better both, I think, overall and in this series because Gasol gives you offense, sure, but Mirotić probably gives you more offense when you consider the impact of his spacing. And the Bulls have plenty of other guys like Rose and Butler who can score. They don't have anyone else who can protect the rim when Gasol is in there. So I think, you know, sad as it is to say, I think Bulls fans should almost be hoping that he, you know, isn't able to play that much the rest of the series, if only so that he forces Thibodeau's hand. You know, I don't like saying that about someone, that like it's good for him to be injured, but given what we've seen of Thibodeau's tendencies, which he did go away from a little bit today anyway, you know, I think that's better for the Bulls.
Yeah, what were your thoughts when they put Jimmy Butler at the four?
Yeah, that was, I was shocked by that, although it was presaged a little bit by the fact that they went with Snell at the four briefly in a totally weird four-guard lineup. So, and that's, Thibs never goes without two bigs, and he did that for much of the fourth quarter, especially once Mirotić picked up three quick fouls in that quarter to get to five. Yeah, I mean, I appreciated the creativity quite a bit. I don't know how much the Bulls have practiced in that alignment, and I definitely think that I'd rather have Mirotić on the floor than Kirk Heinrich, but that said, and we'll get to that too, but yeah, I mean, this was encouraging from Thibodeau, and I think if he can continue this type of player usage for the rest of the series, I would actually make the Bulls favorites. I think they have more talent than this Cleveland team. I mean, really, with Kyrie kind of hobbled, it's rough for Cleveland, especially because they never move the ball at all.
Yeah, I mean, what I was thinking during the kind of the end parts of this game is I had always thought that there was a legitimate title contender somewhere in the Bulls. I just thought they had a lot of talent, and they have a team that in a seven-game series with having a singular individual defender like Butler and team defense and all that, I thought they could do it if they could get the offense going. Today was the first time in the playoffs that I went, oh yeah, that's still there. And I honestly think right now, if they can figure this out in the next 3 weeks, they might be the Eastern Conference team, considering the Love injury, that has the best chance against the Western champion.
Yeah, maybe so. I guess it depends who it is. But I think we may be sleeping on Atlanta a little bit too much. You know, I think they may get it together. Hopefully their kind of nagging injury issues won't catch up to them and sink them as a contender. But so a few more notes on this game before we really get into what happened down the stretch. James Jones, J.R. Smith, and Dellavedova, 8 out of 16 on threes combined. Dellavedova really was excellent. He outplayed Rose in the first half. He was killing Aaron Brooks. I mean, to the point where I suggested it before, and I think Heinrich probably would be a better choice as the backup one right now, just so that they're not going to get killed. Brooks really struggled. He was 1-7 from the field, and I think in only 9 minutes, and was 0-4 on threes. Three of them were pretty much wide open too. So it's really it's too bad. He had a great start to the year and probably won the Bulls some games in the regular season, but since the All-Star break or so, he's really been not very good at all.
Yeah. Is there anywhere else you want to go before we get into the real nuts and bolts of this thing?
Yeah, a couple other observations. One is Derrick Rose's shot selection has been really bad. And, he finally started getting to the rim in the second half. And not only that, but also was using his body and actually getting fouled. He had a quote to that effect before the game that he needed to use his body a little bit more. And he succeeded in doing that. And he got to the line a lot more in the second half and ended up being 9-for-10 for the game. So that was important. But he really just, these mid-range jumpers he takes are just awful shots. Like, he used to actually be a pretty good mid-range shooter, but now when he takes them, they're not the quality of shots that they were before the injury. He's doing a lot more, he's not getting them because guys are going under the screen on him or anything like that. Like, he's got to do some crazy step back. He jumps at like an angle. They're just really, really bad shots, and they're from 20 feet instead of 15. 15 feet, you can kind of make a shot like that consistently. 20 feet, probably not. You agree you need to do a little better?
Yeah, and I had a little, there was a certain announcer was talking about how one of his shot, he shot a fadeaway from a deep two over LeBron, and they said something about, it's a good shot if it goes in. And I'm kind of like, no, that has zero effect on whether it's a good shot or not.
I mean, that step back to his left, like, his body is at, like, a 45-degree angle in the air. Like, it's going sideways. Like, there's just no way you can expect to make that shot consistently if you're him. And especially, when he gets switched on to Thompson, finally, towards the end of the game, he had a couple of nice drives when the shot just didn't go down for him. But there's no reason, especially if there's adequate spacing on the floor with Mirotić out there or the small lineup out there, that he can't do that every time. And if he can't do that, then he needs to just move the ball.
Yeah, and another thing that happens when you have a floor-spreading lineup is that it does make it harder to get those shorter offensive rebounds, and especially depending on what your philosophy is. And so when you take an 18, 19-footer, and it's not as good of a shot, you also have one less person there to try to grab the rebound.
The Bulls did turn the tables on the Cavs on the offensive glass. They had a 38% offensive rebounding rate. Noah had some nice energy earlier, though he just still could not make a shot to save his life. But he at least, his defensive energy was a little better as well early on. So I think, especially playing with Mirotić, which he did in that second quarter, he can get to the point where he's not a huge liability like he is playing with Gasol or Gibson. So that was at least somewhat encouraging for the Bulls. A couple of other notes. LeBron was much more effective on his isolations kind of from the mid-post area in the first half. And one of the reasons for that is that he was really timing the Bulls' defensive 3 seconds very well. And what would happen was Noah or Gasol would start off in the middle of the lane. And then as the 3 seconds would end, it's called two-point nining in the NBA parlance of staying in the lane for as long as you can and then getting out and then getting back in. As soon as the guy had to retreat out, that's when and was moving away from LeBron, that's when LeBron would start his attack, and then you had to get all the way out and then get back. When your momentum was moving away, then that was too slow. He couldn't get there in time, and LeBron would be able to get to the basket on Butler. What Taj Gibson started doing, which was much better, is just staying on the opposite block, but then leaning towards LeBron. And so you just know that when he actually starts his attack, then you can just go over there, as opposed to when the attack starts, you're not really doing anything by standing in the lane if he hasn't started his attack yet. So you might as well wait till he starts that, and then you never have a period where you're actually moving away from the ball where you can be taken advantage of. That was a big help for the Bulls in the second half.
Yeah, it was, and you can think of it kind of like a runner in baseball. The size of the lead versus the way that you lean can make a very big difference in terms of how you actually move.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I think another thing we got to look at, too, is Mike Dunleavy has to get some more credit, and the Bulls front office needs to get some credit for getting him in with the mini mid-level exception 2 years ago. And Dunleavy is an excellent shooter. He's also a fantastic cutter, and a lot of times he will do this move where he'll start on the opposite wing, receive the pass, but he'll have started basically his drive 2 steps before he receives the pass, and then can just go right down the lane. He's not at all a fast guy, but because he just simply starts moving before the pass gets there, he can beat his man. And, you know, we can call that like a Dunleavy cut, I guess. You know, maybe I'll start using that because he's really one of the main guys who does that, where you're not really even, you know, you're just on the wing, but you just start moving before the ball gets there and you can beat your man that way. It's a great play.
Yeah, it is, and especially when your teammates are looking for it, because, yeah, as we said, it's another thing with movement and with leaning, and I think that they use him well, and I feel like, in a way, he can mesh with Mirotić in that way, just because it's another guy who shot you after respect.
Yeah, no, I mean, Dunleavy, without his shooting, and, you know, McDermott considered kind of unplayable, Snell not getting any minutes, I mean, he's just so essential for this team, even at the age that he's at. He's kept himself in fantastic shape. You know, and really his body, which people looked at as, oh, he's so skinny. You know, back when he first started playing in 2002, he was a major liability. He'd get posted up all the time. You know, he'd get ISO'd out. And the league has kind of now come more to what he is able to do, which is, you know, playing smart, help defense, executing a more complex defensive system. You know, teams can't go at him one-on-one the way you could when he first started. And just by not putting on a ton of weight, he's been able to have a lot of longevity, retain a lot of his athleticism, and, you know, shooting obviously is more important than it ever was either. So, you know, he's probably a much more effective player now than he was back in his mid-20s.
Yeah, I definitely would agree with that. One of the other things as we get into this broadly is that this game had substantially fewer turnovers even after the fourth quarter than the other ones. They combined for 22.
Yeah, and I think the Bulls only had, what, 7? Is that right?
I think they had 7 early. I think they ended up getting a few late.
They ended up with 11. Yeah, so never mind. Neither of these teams were forcing a lot of turnovers. And you can criticize both teams for their ISO-heavy offense, and we'll get to that. One thing that does at least do is cut down the turnovers a little bit. You know, less passes mean less turnovers generally. So that was helpful.
Yeah.
So why don't we get down to the last 6 minutes of this game? We pick it up, tied at 82 with about 6 minutes left. And this was the last possession that J.R. Smith was guarding Jimmy Butler, and he just had an easy ISO post-up. It was an example of the additions Butler has made to his game. He just faced him up. Easy Tim Duncan jumper off the glass from about 17 feet. You know, no real resistance from JR, and LeBron was guarding Heinrich, which, you know, doesn't do you a ton of good against this Bulls team, because they're not really moving the ball that much, especially in clutch situations, to where you can help as well as you could, you know, when there's a little more movement and it's useful to help off someone like Heinrich.
Yeah, it's not like if you're facing the Warriors or the Hawks, where when you play a guy off a threat, then they can be in the lanes because the lanes don't matter.
Yeah, so really, the offenses down the stretch were pretty pathetically unimaginative. It was 1-3 pick and roll, 3-1 pick and roll, maybe 3-5 pick and roll if you're Cleveland every once in a while. Like, really, and then just nothing else happening. You know, the number of times that the ball would move from side to side, there's maybe 1 or 2 possessions in the whole last 6 minutes of the game where that would happen. And you know what, like, I think the Bulls only scored 20 points in the fourth quarter. They ended up with 25 ultimately, you know, after that last flurry. But really, I don't think either team was getting great shots down the stretch. And it's because they weren't really running any sort of continuity or offense. It was all just, you know, do one thing, you know, maybe get a switch, try to attack that guy. Not very pretty basketball compared to what a team like the Spurs or the Warriors might be able to do, or the Hawks for that matter.
Yeah, definitely agreed.
That was a lot of what you had. You know, the next possession down, Gibson got switched onto James, and there's a wide open shot, number 3. Thompson, awesome job, got free throws on the offensive rebounds, made them both. And then the next time down for the Bulls, Rose Gibson pick and roll, This was actually a key play. The Cavs switched that to put Shumpert on Gibson, and Thompson was on Rose. And James then went to switch onto Gibson. He had been guarding Butler. They switched him onto Butler, you know, after Butler scored the last time down. But Shumpert wasn't quite ready for that. Rose found Butler, and Shumpert didn't get out of him, and Butler drained a three, make it 87-84. James then came down and pulled up with a 27-footer, no passes, way from the left wing after a pick and roll. Gibson and Butler are basically double-teaming him. Terrible miss. Really just, you know, like we're going to see throughout here, not a lot of creativity from Cleveland, and, you know, no one on Cleveland has the gravitas to tell LeBron that, yeah, we need to run something here other than you just holding the ball for 10 seconds.
Yeah, it felt like 2006 LeBron to me. You know, it was just one of those, I'm just gonna do it. And so often with him, in particularly I noticed it in this series, is that he just feels frustrated for whatever reason. He's just like, I'm just gonna shoot, you know, because it's not even like a late in the shot clock. Just
yeah, fine. That one, that one was better. No passes.
But there were,
he
had a
13 in the clock.
Yeah, he had a couple of those. And you know, there are times that happens. I mean, it's a little bit different when Stephen Curry does that than when LeBron does it.
Yeah, and he was 1 of 7 on threes tonight, 8 out of 25 from the field in total. Just not and. The type of shots he was getting, that was a deserved performance from him. Now, you might expect him to make those tough shots a little more often, but he maybe took what you would consider a good shot. You know, maybe a third of those are good shots. You know, you think that's about right? Like,
yeah, I'd say it's about right.
The next time down, Rose and Gibson run a pick and roll. Surprise, surprise. The Cavs had been switching that with Thompson. They did not switch it this time. And Rose was being guarded by Shumpert. He just kind of worked his way into the lane and did a spin move off of Shumpert, no help at all from Thompson, which was pretty inexcusable. Gibson was just chilling out at the top of the key. Help out on that, you know, make him throw it to Gibson for a free throw line jumper instead of an easy Rose layup. So that wasn't good. Thompson was a little bit late on the help quite a few times during this stretch.
Yeah, I feel like Thompson's been put into a hard thing, especially during this stretch, because even though Mozgov played pretty well, Thompson was the lone big for a lot of this, and I feel like he's good at a lot of things, but being the sole rim protector is not particularly one of them, at least at this point in his career.
Yeah, he had a couple of nights. He had a great block on Rose down in the last minute or so, but he also was late on a couple helps, as we'll get to. Do you think you would have gone with Mozgov or with Thompson or with both down the stretch?
I would have probably gone with both.
Well, I mean, yeah. Even with the Bulls going small, I mean, maybe the Bulls would have matched up big if they'd gone with both of them. But
yeah, I think they would have countered it. And and it's not like the Cavs were particularly using their additional spacing. I mean, you know, it's kind of, I think it would have benefited just from having an extra rebounder and screen setter.
Yeah, I mean, that two big lineup was a total of -1, -4 in its first stint, and then +3 in its second stint in the third quarter. Obviously killed the Bulls in that first game. But I don't know. I think maybe I might have tried it to see what they came up with, but you think that if the, especially because the Cavs were just running a LeBron ISO every time, basically anyway, or 1-3 pick and roll. You might as well just get some more guys onto the offensive glass to rebound there if that's all you're going to be running, because you're not really taking advantage of the spacing at all.
Yeah.
I think ultimately though, I probably would have stuck with the same lineup that Blatt had out there. With the amount of spacing that they did have, they needed Shumpert. Smith was hot. He was hitting some threes. So, and I think Thompson is probably a little bit better option than Mozgov because of his ability to switch out on the perimeter and also fight in the offensive glass just a little bit more than Mozgov. Although Mozgov was excellent protecting the basket.
Yeah, and he helped that early on in the game they weren't calling any fouls.
Yeah, no, that's true. So really, now I have 5 straight possessions by both teams that started with a 1-3 pick and roll. yeah, I mean, that was preceded by another terrible Rose jumper, and then a James ISO and a 15-footer on Butler. But then there was a Butler ISO drive on Shumpert. That didn't really work too well. They got a 24-second violation as he tried to throw it to Dunleavy in the corner. It wasn't a very good pass. Then there was a 1-3 pick and roll with Kyrie and James. And Butler was unbelievable defending these 1-3 pick and rolls. Those are always so tough. Most teams will just switch that, and they didn't want to have Rose guarding James by any means. So that wasn't really an option for the Bulls. But Butler was able to step out on Kyrie, allow Rose to get back to him, and then still stay on the axis between Kyrie and LeBron to prevent the easy pass to LeBron and get back in front of LeBron by the time he would receive the pass. And exacerbating this problem is that Kyrie is just not really a very good passer. Yep. He had a couple of times where he wasn't really able to find guys, whether it was James for a split second on the pick and roll. There was another time later on where Kyrie drove and Kirk Heinrich dug down over off of Smith and forced a turnover from Kyrie, where an easy pass out to Smith. And, you know, Kyrie, of course, had zero assists, which led to that hilarious question in the press conference. Did you see that?
And excellent camera work. Let's not denigrate the camera work.
Well, yeah. So for those who missed it, you want to tell them what happened?
Yeah, sure. So the way that it was cut in the video that I saw, which made it so much better, is that it was the last question of the press conference, and so they only showed that question. They said last question, and it was, I believe it was an ESPN writer asking LeBron, referencing back to a November game when Kyrie had no assists, and apparently LeBron said something like, "You're not going to do that again," to Kyrie. And so he's asking LeBron this question, and LeBron starts his answer, and then the camera pans over to Kyrie, and he's just kind of staring, kind of looking down, and LeBron's doing his whole thing about how there are no excuses and all that stuff, but I just found the whole thing hilarious. I'm sure you have other things to add on it, even though it's only a 30-second clip.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was just, the camera panning over to Kyrie as he's just shaking his head, and they're asking LeBron whether, like, LeBron was, like, whether Kyrie having no assists was acceptable. I mean, it's just like, what kind of answer do you expect out of him? It was pretty remarkable. And I mean, and LeBron, you know, he had some sort of platitude about, oh, you know, it's everyone's fault. Like, you know, we have to make the shots or, you know, whatever, or move the ball better or, you know, and really it was pretty hilarious.
It really, really was. Oh, one other thing I want to mention. On that first 1-3 pick and roll, you were talking about the 24-second violation. The other dynamic, I believe, was that play is that every once in a while this happens. It was a 24-second violation that actually shouldn't have been a 24-second violation because it tipped the rim and the Cavs got it. And it was one of those things that's frustrating because the Cavs, if they had played an advantage or something of that situation, they would have had a fast break. But instead, by calling the 24-second violation, they had to take it out and they didn't get a transition look. And as we saw, Cleveland's half-court sets were uninspired.
Yeah, the refs have done a better job, I think, in recent years
they have
kind of giving the advantage. But yeah, maybe that's one place where they could have. So here we'll pick it up again after the string of 1-3 pick and rolls. Cleveland decides to change up with a 3-5 pick and roll. It gets contained, but then Heinrich loses J.R. Smith. Really, Rose had stuck his neck in there. Gibson was on James just fine. Heinrich just, you know, was on the baseline, turned his head, lost Smith, and really we can go through kind of Kirk Heinrich's record of what he did in the fourth quarter because, you know, really Tony Snell should be out there instead of him. I don't really remember Heinrich having a touch other than maybe at the very end before a shot clock violation occurred that you were talking about. But so he had two nice help plays, one on LeBron where he turned his back and he was able to force a turnover, and the other one was that play where Kyrie ended up dribbling it off his leg. So put those in his ledger. He also did a nice job on one of those 1-3 pick and rolls, staying with J.R. Smith where they tried to run a stagger double for Smith on the other side of the floor. He stayed with him. But then Heinrich also had basically zero shot attempts. The good news for the Bulls, though, was that Kyrie was guarding him most of the time. And while that provides a hiding place for Kyrie, Kyrie is not the most cerebral defender and not the quickest guy, and he also was hampered by injury. So there are a lot of times Kyrie really could have helped and mucked things up much more off of Heinrich than he actually did. And so that was key, that, you know, there wasn't that aware of a defender on him. I think now that he's been getting more minutes, Cleveland, much like they did with Noah starting in game two, will kind of drill it in more that, all right, this is something that you have to help off of. But Heinrich didn't really hurt the Bulls too badly because there wasn't much help off him. I think that was just, you know, Cleveland could have done a better job defensively there.
Yeah, one amazing thing, thankfully, that we have the player tracking stuff on NBA.com now. Kirk Heinrich had 12 touches in this game.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
12 touches!
Yeah, and then Heinrich also, on the negative ledger, lost Smith a couple of times, really for no reason, including on the tying basket. So Snell, I think, could have done a better job. Heinrich, while he is active, can't really close out because he's basically point guard size and he doesn't have much length. So if he loses his guy, it's all over for him. He's not going to be able to contest effectively, especially against a guy like Smith. So really, you know, I think you'd rather see Tony Snell in there. I think it should have been Mirotić once, it got late enough that the five fouls wasn't an issue for him. But if not him and they really want to go small, Snell is the better option there, both from a shooting standpoint and length defensively.
Agreed.
So on that play, Smith drains a three, ties it at 91. The Bulls do a timeout, and then they unveil a nice wrinkle, which is a 1-2 pick and roll with Rose and Heinrich. The Cavs didn't have a plan for this. Kyrie thought it should have been a hedge. Shumpert switched it. And so then Kyrie just commits a totally dumb foul with the Bulls in the bonus.
A horrendous foul.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what he was doing. Just Rose kind of had him beat. I mean, if he was hedging, there's no reason to commit the foul there. And better communication from he and Shumpert. But that was not a play that the Bulls had run quite yet. And so Rose got to the line, made one out of two. And then the next time down, this is the play where they tried to do the 1-3 pick and roll with Smith running off the double screen. They started that off with a UCLA cut. For those who don't know what a UCLA cut is, that is where a big man sets a back screen for the point guard after he passes it to the wing. And Smith passed it to the wing to Irving, and then he went through, received a back screen, was wide open. Kyrie, you know, sort of didn't even look at him. And I hate when teams do that. Like, if you have an action like that, you have to keep the defense honest by, if they don't guard it, like hit the guy, like make them guard the back cut. That's what sets up the next action, which was coming off the double screen. Heinrich defended it well. Kyrie wasn't really even looking that way anyway. And they had to screen and rescreen a couple of times because Butler was just doing such a great job. Finally, on that play, Kyrie got into the lane and, Butler successfully contested him, got the rebound. The next time down, James, who by all accounts is a basketball savant, he showed it on this play. The Bulls ran a 1-2 pick and roll again, but James just decided to start guarding Heinrich, and he switched on to Rose. But and Irving was on Dunleavy. The Bulls probably should have had Dunleavy screen instead, but there wasn't any recognition there. But Rose blew right by James and just missed the layup. It was a good shot for him. It was very, very interesting. If you think of who do you think has declined more in athleticism from 2011, Rose or James? Back then, James would guard Rose at the end of the game in that 2011 Eastern Conference Finals and really just locked Rose down. And in this game, Rose, when he put his mind to it, actually blew past James twice. He wasn't able to finish either time. But, you know, I thought that was pretty telling that it's really – James is not necessarily someone that Rose needs to be scared of anymore defensively.
And as somebody who's almost exactly the same age as LeBron James, what you just said is absolutely horrifying. And completely true.
I know how much of your self-esteem is wrapped up in your athleticism and basketball playing ability, so it must be quite a blow for you.
It is. It really is.
So on this play, Rose blew right by James, went to the left-hand reverse, and got fouled, no call. Got hit right on the arm by James.
Yeah, bad call. Bad no call.
Yeah, so, and there, I'll be very interested to see the report, because there are a lot of fouls that weren't called down the end, which we'll get to. Next time down, it's a 3-5 pick and roll, James and Thompson. LeBron backs down, and Rose was guarding Smith in transition. Rose dug down a little bit, thinking that he could get back to Smith, but Smith actually set up about 4 feet behind the line. LeBron hit him with a nice pass, and JR just missed the shot. Good shot for him. And it's a chance to note, really, and this is something I think we'll see a lot more of in coming years, is how useful it is for guys who can really shoot it, like Smith or Korver, Curry, Klay Thompson, those sort of shooters, to really set up about 3-4 feet behind the line. You might be a little less accurate, but you're going to get so many more shots up or space your man out so much further. And on that play, if Smith is at the line, Rose closes him out. But if he's 4 feet behind the line, he was able to get a shot off. So that's a really, and Korver has been doing that a lot already, and I think we'll see more of that with the really good shooters, and which is a way that those guys are going to become even more effective as time goes on.
Yeah, it's something that I've noted, and the Warriors have done that a little bit this year too, and it helps that they have two guys who are confident shooting from there.
Yeah, so after that miss, Rose gets the switch onto Kyrie in the 1-2 pick and roll again. Kyrie is back on Heinrich, just blows by him. Thompson comes out with a great block. It was just close to a goaltend. We never really saw a replay of that.
I thought it was a goaltend on the fly.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was a great play. But Gibson gets the offensive rebound. He gets absolutely mauled, no call. Finally hits Butler with the shot clock winding down. Butler shoots his three, gets hit in the head by James, no call there either. And then at this point, I think there was a timeout by Cleveland after a shot clock violation. So then Cleveland spices it up with a 3-2 pick and roll with James and Smith. It just turns into another LeBron ISO. And Butler commits kind of a silly foul. James had picked the ball up at the free throw line and then did a step through. Butler ended up kind of holding him. It looked like a pretty good call. And James drained both of his free throws to give Cleveland the lead. And he was actually... didn't play a great game, but was awesome from the line tonight. 10 out of 11, which you don't normally see from him.
Yeah, and it's, yeah. Let's move on. I'll save my comments for after we've had a couple more.
All right,
we're getting into a little stretch here.
So here, then there was a timeout. Tibbs ran a nice play where it's basically a hammer action. And for those who don't know what that is, it's kind of a drive by someone from the wing, you know, usually a wing player. Sometimes he'll do it with a guy posting up. Boris Diaw do it a lot in San Antonio. And they're the ones, I think, who really invented this action. But the drive is kind of a dummy action to draw help. And then a big on the opposite side will set a screen for a shooter to go into the corner. That's kind of the hammer, is that screen. And then you throw the ball to the corner for what's hopefully a wide-open corner three.
Yeah, and if you want to think about it, the most common one with the Spurs is Manu making the pass to Danny Green, from what I recall.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, the Spurs have a million shooters that they run to. But yeah, Manu is great doing that. Diaw is great doing it. But Kyrie actually was on Dunleavy on this play, did a great job of just kind of holding him a little bit, getting through the screen, because Tristan Thompson had helped out on the drive. He wouldn't have been able to get over there and help. So as Gibson set the back screen, so that was a nice job by Kyrie. It wasn't open, and so then Butler was able to stop, reverse pivot, and come back under and get the lay-in. He definitely traveled on that play, if you watch it again. You know, pretty quick in real time. Not a play where the refs are going to be staring at his feet with everything else that's going on, but it was definitely a walk.
Yeah, it's what I call an effective travel, which means that it happened, but you're never going to see the call, so it doesn't really matter that he traveled.
Yeah, I mean, just like that Steph Curry play in the New Orleans game, the second to last three that he hit. But yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if the referee's report says that he traveled, and they'll probably have one of those little stars next to it of like, hey, it was really hard to do this. A couple other notes on this play. The play started with Butler just flaring into the wing and Mirotić screening for him. the Cavs just switched that. JR was on Mirotić. Mirotić was back in the game, thankfully, finally by Thibodeau. And LeBron was on Butler, just switched, kind of a lazy switch. I mean, maybe that's what they were in, to just switch everything, but kind of a lazy switch by LeBron. And then Butler was able to score on J.R. Smith. If LeBron's on him, you know, who knows what that happens. And finally, the other thing is that after setting the initial screen, Mirotić spaced out to the three-point line. That prevented help from James coming down to the lane. He would have been another guy who could have helped, and Butler really was just by himself right under the basket. So that's, once again, the power of shooting prevented James from helping, and Butler was able to hit the huge shot to give him the lead.
Yep. Now we move on to it was the final offensive possession for Cleveland, right?
No, they had two more.
No. Oh, yeah, the J.R. Smith one. Never mind, they had two.
Yeah. So on this play, I think Cleveland used a timeout. They had one remaining after this. There were 31 seconds left. And Blatt had LeBron take it full court. It was a nice design with actually just a straight ISO right-hand straight-line drive from LeBron. Butler was kind of turned his head to look for the screen. And I don't know if James did this on purpose or not, but as soon as Butler turned his head to look for the screen, James accelerated, blew right past him. But Taj Gibson, who was unbelievable defending the rim all night, the Cavs were only able to make one out of six shots at the rim that he contested, according to the SportView data. And he forced a LeBron miss, but also I think we got to say that's a shot that you expect LeBron to make, at least the old LeBron. It was contested by Gibson, but, you know, 2 years ago LeBron, that shot's down 90% of the time.
Absolutely, but then James followed up that disappointment with a really, really smart foul, because Taj was not the guy, you know, not the guy that the Bulls wanted to go to the line, and so he was able to convert what was a very unfortunate thing, because the Bulls got the ball back with enough time to run it out, and they couldn't advance it to a better shooter in time.
Yeah, and that's really a play that, you know, another little thing going down the stretch. James, as a smart player, just fouled Gibson immediately. You should really do that. That should be the instruction to your players when you're in that situation, that foul the guy who gets the defensive rebound, because it's usually going to be a big and not their great free throw shooter. Otherwise, they're going to get it to someone who has a much better chance of making two. As it turned out, Taj Gibson drained both free throws, and it was it ended up being irrelevant. But the process was really good there for James.
Yeah, and then the Cavs went no timeout, which is something that you and I both support, to try to on their what ended up being their last offense possession, now that I'm not jumping the gun.
Yeah, and it's always just, I really like no timeout, unless there's just so little time left, but I really like it when you need a three, because obviously I think whatever play you're going to draw up to get a three is going to be counterbalanced by the opposing coach saying, all right, we're going to switch everything, no threes under no conditions, or set up an intentional foul situation as well. People were saying that Stibbs going to foul. It was really too early for that, in my opinion. I think that shot went up by JR with about 12 seconds left. And with that being the case, I think you really don't want to do the intentional foul until you're under 10 seconds. So on that play, Heinrich lost J.R. Smith again. I mean, there wasn't any kind of a screen at all. Smith got a screen initially from Thompson, which is a flare screen. He wasn't really open. And then he just cut back to the ball, and James found him. And Heinrich, again, you know, didn't have the length to contest, and it was bottom for J.R.
Well, he had a little bit of, I think it's called a brush screen from LeBron, just based on the action, just the way that he went. And the other benefit of going no timeout is that you don't allow the defense to sub, and I presume that they wouldn't have had Kirk Heinrich in the game, though who knows?
Oh, no. They would have had him in. Yeah, Tibbs definitely thinks that Kirk Heinrich is like the greatest two-guard ever defensively. There's no way that I think that Snell would have been.
Would they maybe have had Snell in instead of Derrick Rose?
No, I think that's pretty unlikely too. I think Dibbs would have just stuck with it. And in fact, when they went no timeout, but it was after a free throw, so they did actually have a chance to sub there.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. So no, I think Heinrich is, especially defensively, is Dibbs' guy. So yeah, I mean, that was a great shot. Then Chicago actually went no timeout as well, which I think they're kind of surprised with, and Dibbs, you know, everyone was kind of lazing around looking over at the bench, and Tibbs said, no, take it out, let's go. Rose brought it up, and James, in somewhat of an interesting play, was just suddenly double-teamed Rose, and the reason he's able to do that is because Butler just jogged behind Rose, like Butler's way behind him at the half-court circle, and so James really got a free pass to double-team Rose. Bulls were lucky that James just knocked it out of bounds because Rose was just completely not expecting that at all. And then that set up the final heroics.
And I honestly thought, I still haven't seen a good replay you have. Of I thought there was a chance that LeBron knocked the ball off Rose, but they didn't even really look at it.
Yeah, you know, I'm surprised that that wasn't reviewed at all. Maybe it was just that obvious. Or maybe the refs just thought it might have been a foul too, and so they figured we're just not going to call it either way.
Yeah. Would have been the ref special where the guy was fouled and the ball went off him, but since they only review half of the play, then you get screwed doubly.
Yeah. Well, so what did you think of that last play where Rose had the game winner?
I mean, it's a lucky shot, but it went in. You know, that's, you know, when you have those opportunities, that's what you do. And maybe they could have gotten, you know, maybe they could have gotten something better, but I mean, I'm not gonna knock it. It wasn't that horrendous. It was just a tough shot. Thompson did a much better job closing when I saw the replays than I thought in live action, and it was just one heck of a play.
Yeah, Shumpert did a great job denying Rose the ball. The initial action was to come off of two screens, neither of them really made contact to get Rose the ball in the corner, and after that, Rose, it was pretty close to a 5-second violation. Rose was able to get it then, you know, sort of running back towards half court, but had enough momentum to turn, and Gibson set a really nice screen for him, totally obliterated Shumpert. And it's, even when the other team is switching, it's important, which I'm sure Cleveland was in that late situation, it's important to actually make contact on the screen because then at least when you switch, there's only one guy on there instead of two. And Rose was able to hit a fantastic shot over Thompson. Thompson was right there. You can't really criticize anything that he did. And Rose, he might have even blocked it, but Rose kind of quick shot him a little bit. Rose usually will shoot on the way down, and he kind of just let it go a little bit quicker. And that was enough to get it off. Lucky shot, but really happy for him that he was able to have this moment. And really happy for Chicago, who finally actually won a game other than a game one against LeBron James.
And Rose doing the, I don't even think that counts as a mean mug. I don't even know what his celebration counts as. It was just, but I liked it. It was distinctive.
Yeah, no, it was, again, just to see him have some moments, you know, he hasn't been that fantastic in these playoffs, but he still has had his moments, and I think he's still kind of feeling things out. And don't forget, he just came back from another surgery like a week before the regular season ended. You know, I can't really remember any times where that's gone well for people to come back that quick. I mean, granted, it was more of a minor surgery, not a huge part of his meniscus that was being removed, but still, like, he had surgery. He's coming back having missed 6 weeks and just 1 week basically to get in shape for the playoffs. And considering that, considering what we thought when Derrick Rose initially was announced as having that surgery, I mean, a lot of people thought he wouldn't be back at all. You know, like, oh, Derrick Rose, he takes so long, he's such a wuss, blah, blah, blah. You know, a lot of people thought he wouldn't even come back. A lot of people thought that he wouldn't be able to play that many minutes. A lot of people thought that he wouldn't be effective at all. And I'm really glad that he's proved all those people wrong to at least some degree.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a lot of, you know, emotion and vindication and all of that in basketball, and especially in this playoffs. And I'm excited to see where it goes from here, because that is one of those shots that could really grow in importance if Chicago ends up making a run.
Who's the favorite in this series now?
I still think it's Cleveland, but the box is open now. You know, now if Chicago goes to a more, you know, a more open offense and goes to, you know, uses Mirotić like they can, I don't know that Cleveland has a counter.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of it, as we said, kind of depends on the Gasol injury. I mean, I think at the very least with his hamstring issues, he's now going to be coming off the bench or just not playing as many minutes. So I think that's bad news for Cleveland. Cleveland also has been getting some pretty crazy performances from some of their big guys like Dellavedova and Jones. I don't expect that to continue quite to the level that it has. Those guys really kept those dudes in the game.
And Mozgov in this game, he was fabulous. I mean, yeah. Mozgov, it gets lost in the shuffle. And also, we should mention that LeBron had a couple of spectacular passes to Mozgov in transition during this game, helped by Pau Gasol, you know, not really moving on defense, but to thread the needle a couple times in that beautiful half-court alley-oop. That helps Cleveland in that sense, and even without Love, because if you can get those points, it also encourages the big men to run the floor. They talk about that a lot in college, too, that if you can get the big man a dunk like that, then that makes them more excited to run the floor.
Yeah, Mozgov did a nice job with that. But, I mean, I think, you know, the argument you could say from Cleveland is, well, hey, you know, LeBron hasn't shot well. We expect him to shoot better. Kyrie will be better. But, you know, I'm not sure if that's true. I mean, LeBron has had three games now shooting under 50%. I don't think he's shot over 50% in any game yet in the playoffs, you know, against teams that have not amazing defensive teams, although I think the Bulls looked a lot better tonight, especially, you know, with Gasol not playing as much. I'm not sure if I expect LeBron to be efficient. I mean, he may have one game where he really gets hot with the jumper. I expect him to probably have that. But overall, you know, I think tonight's game or maybe at the very least game two is more going to be the norm for him than, you know, a really explosive scoring game. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's definitely fair. I do think, like you, that there will be one game that he'll just go off. I feel like it's going to happen. But one of the things that I found most interesting about this series so far is that based on shooting and a lot of other things, it feels to me like home court doesn't matter a whole lot. That's not to say the crowd isn't great. The crowd did very well tonight at the United Center. But it doesn't feel like that is making the difference. You know, it's just some nights these guys are hot, some nights they're not. I mean, James Jones had that huge night in Cleveland. I don't think that was because he was at home in his own bed. I just think, you know, it was just James Jones had a night.
Yeah, I think if the Bulls are going to have a little bit better of player usage, I think I would have to make them the clear favorites. They also have a game up and the home court advantage right now on Cleveland. I mean, I think what it's going to come down to from now on, though, if Kyrie outplays Derrick Rose, then they'll have a chance. If Rose is going to outplay Kyrie, then I think Cleveland is in big trouble in the series.
Yeah, I agree with that, and we'll move from one series where a team has home court and a 2-1 lead to another series where a team has home court and the 2-1 lead, which is the Clippers. There are a lot of different things to take away from this game, but to me, the biggest takeaway is that barring a huge setback, I think the Clippers win this series going away.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, I tweeted it as soon as the Clippers went up 20 towards the end of that third quarter, that I thought this series, barring a Clippers injury, might be over. And the reason for that is Houston just can't stop them.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that happens that throughout the year I was, you know, especially when Dwight was healthy for those limited stretches, I was impressed with Houston's defense on the aggregate. And a big part of that, obviously, is that Patrick Beverley's not playing. But consistently throughout the playoffs, their defense has not been very good. And you can blame a lot of different factors for that. And it hasn't been Dwight Howard. Dwight Howard has played very well, in my opinion. But their defense is not playing well enough to fuel their offense or even to stem the tide.
Terrence Jones he scored okay in the first half, but he really has just been totally miserable defensively. I was surprised that we didn't see from the Rockets really at all. I don't recall it. Certainly not in the first half, that small lineup that basically won them game two. Maybe they felt like with Paul out there that wasn't something that they could go to. But again, with Smith couldn't hit a jumper. Jones was just totally unaware defensively so many times, but no chance at stopping Blake Griffin one-on-one either. With those two guys not really working, why not just go with Ariza and double team or do whatever you have to do. I mean, and get a little more shooting on the floor, because those power forwards just aren't getting it done for Houston.
Yeah, and while Jason Terry and the cavalcade of, you know, strange Houston guards now that Patrick Beverley's out, did an all right job on Redick in the first two games. He had a lot of looks tonight and did a nice job as well.
Yeah, and I mean, Houston, just especially with Beverley out, they really only have two good defensive players on the roster. You know, Corey Brewer kind of has that reputation, but he's kind of spacey defensively. He doesn't have much strength. He's not really good enough on point guard. You know, they use him on Paul some, and he's not really very good at that. He got killed by Stephen Curry a couple years ago when he was on the Nuggets in the playoffs. Not a great point guard defender. And really, you know, outside of Ariza and Howard, they don't have anyone who's a great defensive player. So I guess it shouldn't be that surprising. Harden has really regressed with his defense. He was guarding Rivers a lot of the time when he was getting off. But I think, you know, today is really more about just the unbelievable redemptive story. And when I say that, I'm talking about Spencer Hawes.
Yes! It is about Spencer Hawes. And why this carries over, I mentioned this at the outset, is Houston didn't really have much they could do once the Clippers had that extra guy that they had to pull outside, because what it led to was just an absolute ton of penetration. And Hawes did a decent job in, I believe it was defense and rebounding. I thought he played a pretty solid game.
Yeah, he's actually not that terrible protecting the rim defensively. I mean, asking him to move, putting him in there with Jordan is a little difficult for them defensively. That was one of the big reasons I didn't like that signing perhaps as much as some people did, because I didn't think that that combination could work defensively. But also, when you have, you know, the power forwards that the Rockets have who aren't that big of a threat shooting the ball, it's less of an issue for Hawes with his mobility. But his spacing of the floor, I mean, basically what he was doing, especially during that amazing run to end the third quarter, where I think they ended up scoring 23 points in a row over the third and fourth quarter, when Rivers was just killing it, Rivers was able to beat his man off the dribble, something that he's always been good at, actually. That's really been one of his few NBA skills. But usually there'll be help there, and then he throws up some crappy floater that, you know, doesn't really have much chance of going in. But with Hawes out there, the floor was so spaced that Rivers was able to blow by a guy like Harden, who was guarding him a lot of the time, and then just get right to the basket with very little resistance. Terrence Jones was in. He was the only big, I think, at that point, he was playing center. And he was just not able to do anything at the rim other than just foul Rivers one time. Very rough stretch for him. Very rough stretch overall for Houston. And, you know, I think they're probably about done in this series unless, you know, something happens to Paul again. How did you think Paul looked?
I thought he looked pretty good. I mean, I was waiting to see how his jumper turned out, and it looked solid, you know. He ended up making some threes later on. But, you know, he's definitely not 100%, but it's remarkable to me that the Clippers might not need him close to 100% to close out this series.
Paul just is such a cerebral player, and really, although he's quick and he's strong, he's nowhere near the athlete that he used to be. He just turned 30 actually a couple days ago. But, you know, his brain is just so good. He's increased his skill level with his jumper, and he's able to just operate and get to his spots, and he's able to rise up off that right foot for his jumper, so he still has that going to his right. That's his favorite shot. And he had some wonderful assists in this game. Houston doesn't have anyone who can make him work defensively. It's just, you know, he's just guarding Terry or Prigioni the whole time. So, you know, I think, you know, Paul better get healthy for if they play the Warriors or the Grizzlies, who do have excellent point guards. But for now, I think, you know, they'll be able to get by Houston and just outscore them.
Over under on how many times, if that series happens, Chris Paul accidentally hits Mike Conley in the face?
Well, hopefully we won't ever find out.
One other stat I wanted to put in: Dan Wojcicki of the OC Register, who's the Clippers beat writer for them, put out a stat that I think kind of puts this series in a nutshell so far, and that's the Clippers have outscored the Rockets by 10 or more points in 4 of the 12 quarters that they played so far, which is 1/3. That's insane. You know, to have something like that where you've had that many dominating quarters on an opponent.
Yeah, and you're also seeing, I think, as well, the Rockets kind of lack of depth. I think if I were them, I might just, like, give a little bit more run to even someone like Nick Johnson and, you know, maybe hope that he can get hot enough to keep the defense honest from three. I mean, he's no worse of a three-point shooter than someone like Corey Brewer is probably. And Johnson at least can get into guys a little bit, have him hound Chris Paul for some minutes, you know, because Paul can't really bring the ball up against pressure in his current hamstring-headed state. So, you know, maybe even go with someone like Papanikolaou and hope that he can get hot from the outside rather than having someone at the four. But they, what they're doing right now just isn't working.
Props on talking about Nick Johnson and not putting in a go Wildcats. Though I am a big Nick Johnson fan, too.
Yeah. All right. Anything else to talk about on this series? It was such a blowout. There's not really that much more to say, in my opinion.
No, I mean, there, with the way that this series has been, it's been kind of up and down to a point. There is a part of me that goes, oh yeah, you know, Houston could totally just blow the doors off them in game four. I don't expect it, but there is a very real chance of that. And then we're going to be sitting there going, I have even less of an idea where it's going now, but it's unlikely.
Yeah,
but possible.
I don't think they're not, I mean, if they win, they might get into some shootout and outscore the Clippers, but I don't see their defense being able to slow down. This is the number one offense in the NBA, and this Houston defense is not impressed during the playoffs. I don't see them being able to slow the Clippers down enough to where they could ever blow them out in this series, frankly.
Yeah, and I'm really excited. I think that particularly the other three games, well, actually, sorry, I'll take out the Hawks game, but the Warriors game tomorrow, and then Cavs-Bulls on Sunday will be possible swing games for those two series.
Yeah, they really will. So we're looking forward to those. We've probably gone on long enough, but this is a classic Game 3 between the Bulls and Cavs. We'll see what happens in Game 4. I mean, I think still the winner of that game is going to win the series. We said that if the Bulls were going to be serious about winning the series, they had to take both of these home games and be up 3-1. So until then, we will be back on Sunday recapping both Saturday and Sunday's action. Follow me on Twitter, NateDuncanNBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. We're also, you can subscribe on iTunes. Give us a rating. That is always much, much appreciated for our future prospects. And we will talk again Sunday night. Thank you.